Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, please press star one on your touch-tone phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now, I will turn the meeting over to Ms. Bindu Tharian. You may begin.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for today's COCA conference call on travel medicine and the pre-travel consultation. We had some technical difficulties earlier, and we want to thank you for your patience. We are pleased to have Dr. Gary Burnett here with us to speak about this topic. Dr. Burnett is a medical epidemiologist on the Travelers Health Team at the CDC. He previously served as a medical officer in the U.S. Navy, where he was also involved in preparing travelers for international destinations. The objectives for today's call are for medical providers to understand the extent of U.S. travel abroad, morbidity and mortality in travelers, the importance of pre-travel consultation, elements of the pre-travel consultation, including the risk assessment of patients and the risk management of patients. Dr. Burnett, you may begin.
Thank you very much. Well, welcome all. I appreciate you joining me for this presentation, which we hope will be the first in a series of travel medicine presentations. I am joined today by Dr. Christy Reed, who will help with answering questions at the end of this presentation. So as was mentioned, I will be talking today about the pre-travel consultation. For tourists or for business travelers, for persons returning from their countries of origin to visit friends and relatives, for missionaries or for aid workers, in fact, for all travelers, an important step in their travel preparation is a visit to their primary care provider or to a travel medicine specialist. In my mind, this is as important as booking the air tickets or arranging the accommodation. These are all activities that help to ensure a successful trip. Moving to the second slide, it is my hope to provide an overview of some of the issues covered during the pre-travel consultation. We first need to discuss why travel medicine is fast becoming a well-recognized subspecialty. We will look at some of the data related to travel health epidemiology. We will then need to review the important elements of the patient risk assessment, such as a review of the patient's health and a review of the intended itinerary. We will look at some of the sources of information available to both the provider and the patient. And we will briefly outline some of the major risks faced by the traveler. We will then discuss the elements of patient risk management, such as vaccines, medications, and counseling. Next slide. Many people are surprised by the number of Americans who travel abroad each year. This graph shows the number of U.S. residents who traveled abroad from 1995 to 2005. You will notice the general upward trend, the reaction to the events of 2001, and the subsequent resurgence in numbers for 2004 and 2005. In 2005, over 60 million Americans traveled outside the country. Next slide. This is another graph looking at international travel. The blue, red, and green curves, measured on the y-axis on the left, indicate travel by U.S. residents. This is a breakdown of the numbers seen on the previous slide. I would like to emphasize the orange curve, which is measured on the y-axis on the right. This is the number of worldwide arrivals, that is, all international arrivals around the world. You will note that in 2005, there were more than 800 million international trips. Next slide. The question is often asked, where do U.S. residents travel? Data from the Health Style Survey of 2005 indicate that around 17% of Americans traveled abroad in the previous year. Of those, around 25% traveled to Canada, over 30% traveled to Mexico, more than 20% traveled to Europe, and over 25% visited the Caribbean. Sizable numbers also visited Australia, New Zealand, Central and South America, Japan, Oceania, and the Pacific Islands, Africa, and the Middle East. Next slide. Many travelers are returning to their country of origin or to their parents' country of origin to visit friends and relatives. These travelers are often referred to as VFRs, visiting friends and relatives. VFRs make up a substantial proportion of U.S. travelers. Foreign-born U.S. residents increased 57% from 19.8 million in 1990 to 31.1 million in 2000. 20% of the U.S. population are first or second generation immigrants. And lastly, in 2004, VFRs accounted for nearly 50% of U.S. international travelers. This group faces unique health challenges while traveling. For example, they have often lost acquired immunity to many infectious diseases, and they have different assumptions of the health risks they face in their current countries of origin. Next slide. This slide examines travelers' health risks. It can be seen that approximately 50% of travelers will experience some health problem while abroad. 8% will need to be seen by a physician, and 5% will be confined to bed. 300 in 100,000 will be admitted to hospital, 50 in 100,000 will require air evacuation, and 1 in 100,000 will die while traveling abroad. What can be done to prevent this? One important step is for the traveler to consult with a medical provider while in the planning stages of their trip, preferably 4 to 6 weeks before their departure. This brings us to a closer examination of the pre-travel consultation. Next slide. The first step of the consultation is the risk assessment. This is an individualized evaluation of the patient's health, their medical issues, and their travel plans, and an evaluation of their particular attitudes towards risk, that is, their likely behavior patterns while traveling, and the level of security that they are comfortable with. Firstly, looking at medical issues. This is a careful examination of the patient's health and how it might be affected by travel. There are age-specific risks associated with travel. For example, the very young and old have a different risk profile to certain infectious diseases. Certain medical histories, such as underlying illness, may be exacerbated. Immunosuppression will, among other things, increase the risk of certain infections. Therefore, a careful history, systems review, medication use, and vaccination history is required. Allergies and contraindications to vaccines and medications are an important consideration. Next slide. Pregnancy, breastfeeding, and conception plans have serious implications when deciding on the fitness of the patient for travel, the advisability of the itinerary, the vaccines and medications that they can receive, and the special counseling that they will require. The provider also needs to assess the potential risk-taking behaviors of the patient. Again, special counseling may be required, or medication and vaccinations not offered to regular travelers may be suggested. Next slide. We're on the travel itinerary slide now. An important part of the risk assessment is a careful evaluation of the proposed travel plans. A detailed and full itinerary is required, including dates of travel, duration, and all locations to be visited, including all stopovers. There's a vast difference in individual traveling styles. Is the patient a backpacker or a luxury tourist? Will their trip be confined to major cities? Or will they spend time in rural environments? Do they intend to hike and camp, or will they be staying in hotels and resorts? Are they there to conduct business, to participate in adventurous activities, or will they possibly be part of a humanitarian effort in difficult circumstances? All this information needs to be factored into the risk assessment. Next slide. This brings us to a quick review of some of the resources available to both the provider and the patient. There's an expanded list of these resources at the end of the presentation, which I will not cover at this time. The Travelers Health Team at the CDC maintains a comprehensive website aimed at meeting the informational needs of the traveling public. I will look at this website a little bit more closely in the next few slides. The CDC also produces the Yellow Book, or health information for the international traveler, which is published every 2 years. Information from the Yellow Book is available on the Travel website. The World Health Organization maintains a similar website and also produces a Green Book on international travel and health. The State Department has a Travelers World website, and many organizations, both local and international, such as the International Society of Travel Medicine, offer comprehensive websites advising travelers on their health needs. Next slide. This is the CDC's Travelers Health homepage. It is usually ranked in the top 5 CDC sites in web use. The primary audience for the site are the traveling public and health professionals who advise travelers. Content areas include travel notices and announcements, the online Yellow Book, as I mentioned, regional destination pages, and various resources such as the Yellow Fever Registry, travel medicine clinics, and the ability to contact the Travelers Health Team. There are additional topics on diseases from A to Z, traveling with pets, children, and for special needs travelers. There's also information for the travel industry. Next page. These are the informational pages for regional destinations. Efforts are currently underway to provide country-specific information, and this should be online in the very near future. Next page. The website also provides current information about situations that may impact the health of travelers. CDC issues different types of notices for international travelers. They describe both the levels of risk for the traveler and recommended preventive measures to be taken at each level of risk. There are 4 levels. Firstly, in the news. These are reports of sporadic cases where there's no increased risk for travelers over the baseline. Secondly, outbreak notices. These are outbreaks in limited geographic areas or settings where there is increased risk, but it is definable and limited to specific settings. The travel health precaution. This is an outbreak of greater scope affecting a larger geographic area. There is increased risk in some settings, along with risk for spread to other areas. And finally, the travel health warning, where there is evidence that the outbreak is expanding outside the area or populations initially affected. There is increased risk because of evidence of transmission outside defined settings and or inadequate containment measures. Next slide. This pie chart summarizes the major causes of death in international travelers. You will observe that the greatest single cause of death, almost 50% of all deaths in overseas travelers, are caused by cardiovascular problems, indicated by the blue slice. Deaths related to medical causes, indicated in green, are ranked next at approximately 25%. Injuries in red are the cause of approximately 20% of deaths. Somewhat surprisingly to some people is that infectious diseases, indicated in yellow, are a minor contributing factor. That being said, it should be remembered that many infectious diseases are preventable either with prophylactic medications or vaccinations. Next slide. This slide lists some of the infectious diseases that could affect travelers. This is by no means a complete list, but it does represent the diseases which travel medicine providers need to be aware of. Because this presentation is an overview of the pre-travel consultation, I will not be able to examine any of these diseases in any depth. It is hoped that future presentations will be able to do this topic justice. Each of these diseases has a particular epidemiology and a reasonably defined geographic range. Some are preventable with medications, other with vaccines, and some are only prevented with personal protective measures. It therefore behooves the practitioner to become familiar with these details. Detailed information can be found on the websites I mentioned earlier, particularly the CDC website. Next page. We saw in an earlier slide that injuries make up approximately 20% of all deaths during international travel. This graph shows the breakdown of these injuries. The point to be made here is that motor vehicle accidents and drowning are the largest cause of injury deaths in travelers. The high risk of motor vehicle accidents is particularly relevant in the developing world, where tourists are 4 to 5 times more likely to be involved in road trauma than locals. Wounds sustained in these countries are at higher risk of turning septic, and emergency medical services are often rudimentary. Next slide. Apart from the risk of infectious disease and accidental injury, there are other risks to the international travel which may have a serious impact on health. Many of these risks also have a characteristic epidemiology, and certain destinations may pose a higher risk than others. For example, a study of various information sources will indicate those countries or regions with a higher incidence of violent crime towards tourists. Other countries with harsher climates may pose certain environmental risks, and certain dermatological disorders may be more common in the tropics. Next slide. Immunizations play an important part of the risk management of the individual traveler. This is a topic which needs to be understood in some depth, but unfortunately, due to time constraints, will only be briefly touched upon today. Providers should ensure that all travelers are up to date with their routine immunizations, including an annual influenza vaccination. Yellow fever vaccine is a required vaccine for entry into many countries. Providers can consult the CDC's Yellow Book or travel website to see which countries require this vaccine. Recommended travel vaccines include hepatitis A, hepatitis B, typhoid, and depending on the travel destination, other vaccines may be recommended, such as rabies, polio, meningococcal, and Japanese encephalitis. Next slide. Another important aspect of risk management is the provision of appropriate medications to international travelers. An assessment of the patient's risk for exposure to malaria is essential. If any risk exists, travelers should be placed on a prophylactic regimen, the choice of which depends on the travel destinations and the known epidemiology of the disease in these locations. Consideration needs to be given to the species of Plasmodium present, the resistance to medications, and the expected compliance of the patient. For those travelers who may be unable to get urgent medical care, consideration should be given to a self-treatment regimen. Travelers to the developing world would benefit from a short course of antibiotics to be self-administered in the event of persistent diarrhea. And certain travelers may also benefit from medication to prevent the symptoms of altitude and motion sickness. Next slide. We're now on the patient counseling slide. The third and last component of the patient risk management is counseling. This is an extremely important element of the consultation and may require a substantial amount of time. Counseling should always be tailored to suit the individual traveler and will be based on the risk assessment completed earlier. For those patients with existing health problems, it is important that they understand the impact that travel risks and stresses may put on their conditions. They need to be advised on how to maintain their current health status and may require help with planning their trip. For example, they may need counseling on the importance of continuing current medications, seeking medical care at their destination, special diet considerations, and so on. Travelers may also need counseling on the advisability of their itinerary. For example, pregnant women may wish to avoid areas with a high malaria risk. Or elderly travelers may be advised to make changes in destination in order to avoid the required yellow fever vaccination. Next slide. As part of a traveler's preparation for their trip abroad, they may need to be advised on the importance of adequate medical insurance, especially for hospitalizations or emergency evacuations. Depending on their risk and destination, they may require advice on how to obtain medical care abroad. In certain circumstances, care may be prearranged. Travelers should also be advised to be aware of travel notices placed on both the CDC and State Department websites. Finally, the importance of hand washing and maintaining good hygiene should be stressed. Next slide. We will now examine a number of slides which outline precautions that travelers can take to ensure their own health. We start with the environmental precautions. Long-distance air travel is associated with certain risks such as DVTs and jet lag, and patients can be advised on how to prevent or manage this. Travelers to countries with extreme environmental conditions should be advised on sun protection, the extremes of heat and cold, and how to avoid dehydration and heat injuries, or hypothermia and frostbite, and on the possibility of altitude sickness. Water recreation can pose a substantial risk, especially the risk of accidental injury or death. Certain bodies of water should be avoided due to parasitic infections or contamination. Next slide. Food and water precautions. Diarrhea is a common ailment in travelers, especially those to the developing world. Travelers should be advised to drink only bottled water, select their foods carefully, and choose well-cooked items that are still hot. Many items should be avoided if possible. For example, salads and raw vegetables may have been washed in contaminated water. Unpasteurized dairy products may have a risk for diseases such as brucellosis. Street vendors often have suboptimal hygiene standards and should be avoided. And ice in developing countries is usually produced with local tap water and has the risk of contamination. Next slide. Vector precautions. Patients should be advised that any prophylactic medications or vaccinations that they receive should be considered the last line of defense in the prevention of many vector-borne diseases. The efficacy of medications and vaccines is never 100%. Personal protective measures are essential in preventing these diseases and should be considered the first line of defense. All these measures are designed to prevent the vector from biting the traveler. Some simple methods are covering exposed skin with clothing, using an insect repellent containing at least 20% and up to 50% DEET, the use of permethrin to treat outer clothing and bed nets, the use of insect screen and, where possible, air conditioning, the use of aerosol insecticide indoors and pyrethroid coils outdoors, and the regular inspection for ticks after outdoor activities. Next slide. Bloodborne and STD precautions. Depending on the risk profile of the traveler, The provider may wish to discuss the risks associated with unprotected sexual activity. The traveler also needs to be aware of the risks associated with blood-borne infections. Particular advice may be given regarding automobile accidents and the possible requirement for surgery and blood products. Elective dental or surgical procedures should be avoided in certain countries. And tattooing and body piercing also pose a risk of blood-borne disease. Next slide. Animal precautions. In areas with a risk of rabies, patients should be advised to avoid all animals, including domestic animals. While certain species of animal are often associated with rabies, any bite or scratch from any animal should be medically evaluated, and post-exposure immunization and immunoglobulin should be considered. Travelers also need to be aware of the risk of envenomation from snakes, spiders, and certain marine animals. Next slide. We're on the injury and crime slide. We have discussed earlier the risks of motor vehicle accidents. Travelers should also be aware of the risk to pedestrians and should avoid night travel where possible. Seatbelts and infant car seats should always be used. Travelers should be aware of the risks associated with local crime activity and should be encouraged to maintain their situational awareness. They may also be targeted for scams and violent crime. Next slide. As part of the preparation for travel, travelers should be advised to put together a travel emergency kit. This will differ somewhat depending on the destination of the traveler, but usually it will contain a copy of their medical records, an extra pair of glasses, all their prescription medications, and then a variety of over-the-counter medications and supplies that will help them deal with any minor health problems. Next slide. Post-travel care. While routine post-travel checkups are not usually recommended, it is advised that long-term travelers or adventure travelers or expatriates who have been in the developing world for an extended period receive a post-travel checkup. Any patient who experiences fevers or chills, sweats, persistent diarrhea or weight loss should be evaluated on return. One important point to note is that any fever in a traveler returning from an endemic area should be considered malaria until proven otherwise. And that ends the presentation. I should point out that there are a few additional slides on resources. And if we are unable to get all your questions today, you may email questions to coca@cdc.gov. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Brunette. That was a very informative presentation. And now we can open up the lines for the question and answer session.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Please unmute your line and record your first and last name when prompted. To withdraw your request, press star 2.
Yeah.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. One moment. Our first question comes from Kathleen Pope. You may ask your question. Ms. Pope, your line is open.
Oh, okay. I didn't have any questions prepared. I didn't know I had a question. Sorry.
Leslie, you may ask your question.
Hi. I actually have two questions. On the slide that demonstrates deaths related to international travel, I was wondering under the medical listing, if there were some specific causes to include with that, i.e., is that like diabetes, blood pressure, And then my second question was, when you're talking about a post-travel exam, you recommended it for long-term travelers. What would you identify as long-term?
Thank you very much. I appreciate those questions. Firstly, as regards to medical issues that might contribute to death in the international traveler, you're quite right. General medical issues such as diabetes and high blood pressure all contribute to this factor. Did you have anything else you wanted to ask?
Patient's underlying condition is usually the contributing factor, and cardiovascular would be the majority.
Okay.
And sorry, your second question was?
Yeah, you recommended a post-travel examination. One of the categories you said was for long-term travelers. What do you use as criteria for a long-term traveler? Is there a specific time frame you use?
No specific time frame. And it's not just time as such that should be factored into this. It's also got to do a lot with the type of travel that they undertook. But I would generally think that someone who'd been overseas in high-risk areas for more than a couple of weeks or had been in backcountry areas where they're high-risk would probably benefit from a checkup.
Great. Thank you.
Nancy Jo Armenta, you may ask your question.
Thank you. We have some teenage students that are very soon, like in the next 2 weeks, going to travel to India without any immunizations. We have an area of, or a pocket of folks in our area that generally parents waive in immunizations because they don't believe in them or, you know, a variety of reasons. Is there anything at all that we can do other than try and educate those parents, which we've been trying to do for about 2 or 3 weeks? What would you recommend?
Well, that is one area of the world in which poliovirus is still actively circulating, so it sounds like you've done a great deal of education with them. I don't know if those sorts of factors might help. The other factor being that the majority of cases of typhoid in the United States are imported in travelers and primarily from that part of the world. So I don't know if a little extra ammunition might help you.
That's what we've been trying to do is educate them because we haven't been successful in pulling in very many of those students for immunizations.
The next level of behavior is what you would talk about then, is that if they are resistant to the ideas of prophylaxis, then they're stressing the importance of behavior. Most of the foodborne infections are transmitted through food and water, so strict adherence to the hygiene measures recommended, and the importance of insect repellent. One wonders if they're leery of immunizations, how they feel about insect repellent, but even as Gary mentioned, for malaria, we never rely just on prophylactic medications, but it's considered a three-part strategy, one being the medication, two being barrier methods, advising people of the times that those pests and mosquitoes bite. Malaria, mosquitoes that transmit are dusk to dawn. So emphasizing all of their behaviors, bed net, long sleeves. And then to insect repellent, that it's still needed on exposed surfaces such as hands, face. The other item we also try to convey is that there are a variety of other mosquitoes that bite at different times of the day during daytime biters, and there are currently outbreaks going on in the area of dengue, chikungunya. It depends on where they're particularly going. There's some other viruses that are transmitted by arthropods that are, or excuse me, transmitted by mosquitoes that are in different pockets. So at that point, then it comes down to strict behavior. Is that helpful?
Yes, very. I thank you so much.
Dr. Robert E. Desmond, you may ask your question.
What's the current thinking on the use of preventive medication for travelers' diarrhea? I'm thinking particularly people who are immunosuppressed or have HIV.
Well, that is a complicated topic. Immunosuppression, we could have a whole session on that. And on HIV, one tends to look, which you are probably already familiar, at what the person's current CD4 count is, and so what level of immunosuppression that we consider that they have. The strict adherence to hygiene measures that I just discussed with the previous caller. And then depending on the degree of immunosuppression, whether they're within the period between bone marrow transplant and 2 years, in some cases the travel is just not recommended. So it's a range of philosophies. But for the traveler's diarrhea, there are products that have been recommended. There's the Pepto-Bismol. Again, adherence. It's several tablets several times a day and for approximately 3 weeks. So, again, compliance in terms of whether individuals are compliant, whether those medications are interactive with any of the medications they're taking, and then they're not 100%. The other that you're mentioning has been recommended on occasion if there is someone who desperately has to go to a meeting. It's a high-end sports performer who must perform for a short visit. Very limited set of circumstances that it's been considered, and it's not 100%.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Malik, you may ask your question.
Yes, hi. I was wondering that the Saudi government, as probably everybody knows, has mandated the meningococcal vaccine and a doctor's visit for people going to visit for Hajj or whatever, make the religious pilgrimage. But I think there have been some problems with the new meningococcal vaccine. And I was wondering, I mean, is there any way that, I mean, nobody's coming back with meningitis or anything to Saudi Arabia, and I think the CDC also, MMWR also did something that showed that there really hadn't been any cases, so many people came back as carriers, had nasopharyngeal swabs were positive. Do we still really need that vaccine? Is there any way to, like, go around getting that meningococcal vaccine? Do you think there's a need for it, basically, traveling to Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, I do think there is a need for it because one can't predict the future necessarily from the past.
Mm-hmm.
There are two vaccines. One has the age limit 11 to 64, and the other one is from 2 to a different age group. There were some initial reports, I think that might be what you're referring to, of the Guillain-Barré with the Menactra, but I think that's still being determined as to whether those are coincidental events, because you would expect a certain amount in that age population that were suddenly vaccinating now, but you do always have the option of the other vaccine to use.
Uh-huh.
Yes, it is still strictly recommended, and the Saudi government does require it, I believe, in order for the person to gain entry.
Right. So although there haven't been any cases, you still think that everybody should, in your opinion as a doctor, you still think everybody should be vaccinated, like, totally, right?
Well, one of the reasons there have been no cases is that it's herd immunity by a vaccinated population.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Pat Patterson, you may ask your question.
Hi. Thank you. I was just wondering about your recommendation for the Pepto-Bismol. I have families that travel, and I am a little concerned with the salicylate in Pepto-Bismol and Fry syndrome. Do you have any concerns? Have you seen anything like that?
Well, actually, as you said, those are one of the reasons that prophylactic treatment in advance of travel is still being debated and not strongly recommended. You're right in terms of issues with co-infections with other viral infections.
Mm-hmm.
The strong adherence, although it's not the popular, the strong adherence to the food and water precautions are what's emphasized because they can be maintained, although they are subject to behavior.
Okay, and I had one other comment. I was very curious to hear the phone call about the school trip going to India and the parents not allowing their kids to be immunized. I just wanted to comment that we made the decision or are making the decision to not allow those kids to participate in the trip as sort of a risk-benefit decision, similar to when we would exclude them from school because of a measles outbreak if they had not been vaccinated with measles. So just wanted to comment on that. I don't know if anybody else has had to make that decision or not.
Thank you. That's an important tool, I think.
Right.
Ann Kindlin, you may ask your question.
Thank you. I was just wondering, the slide about the incidence of illness abroad noted such a small amount of infectious disease. Given the emergence of new infectious disease in the last 10 to 15 years, would you think that that would be a larger number at this point?
The slides in question were actually just deaths abroad. And so in terms of illnesses, that would be a different story. But deaths, let me back up. Finding rates among travelers is an interesting proposition. We must get the data where we can, but there's not a clear indication of how many people travel to each area. We do surveys and can estimate, so it's difficult to come up with rates. This paper that we presented the data on deaths was a little bit easier since to bring someone back into the United States, there's some permits involved, and so they were able to work with the consuls and Department of State. So just to make sure that those presentations were related to deaths. When we do look at infections, and a topic we hope to address in another point, some of the vaccine-preventable diseases, for example, measles, typhoid that I mentioned earlier, hepatitis A, for measles and typhoid, the majority of cases in the U.S. are imported. And hepatitis A, the last survey indicated that a third of the cases were imported. So for illnesses, yes, the perception would be different. Those slides did discuss death.
Oh, thank you for clarifying that, because I didn't realize it was death as opposed to the incidence of illness. So I'll look forward to your next topic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Richard Tanner, you may ask your question.
Regarding brittle asthmatic traveling to Quito, are there any special risks for them at that altitude? And additionally, anything that can be done to mitigate or prepare them for it? And additionally, if they began at the Amazon, basically the lower altitude, and progressed to Quito, would that add any risk?
Okay. So you have a brittle asthmatic, and I'm not sure what age?
50.
50.
Okay. Successfully traveled there 3 times previous last year. Ended up with a course of steroids during the trip to so they could sleep.
Okay. So has tolerated altitude before and doesn't have necessarily oxygen deprivation, although it sounds like he is getting a little older, perhaps. And the question would always be whether there are any other respiratory triggers or respiratory infections. But progression, slower progression, would seem to allow better accommodation for his oxygen needs. However, altitude illness is idiosyncratic, and such that even if a person has traveled successfully in the past, one can't always guarantee that they will tolerate the change to altitude on a subsequent trip. I'm not sure of what his existing regimen is, but I would imagine it involves daily steroids.
Yes.
But that would be something to consider in terms of whether that dosage might be perhaps adjusted well enough in advance and maximizing any other conditions in his asthma, although if it's brittle, it sounds like you probably have already done that. If beyond that level, we'd be happy. There are some additional resources on altitude medicine that we can refer you to that might be more helpful beyond that level for you.
That'd be good.
Do you want to send an email to Dr. Burnett, and we'll be able to communicate that way?
Certainly.
If you can email coca@cdc.gov, we can get that information over to you.
Okay, great. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Chris Gertz, you may ask your question.
Thank you very much. I do have two quick questions. The first one's regarding immunocompromised, especially HIV patients. My standard statement to patients in terms of the clinical application of yellow fever vaccine, as long as the CD4 count is above 200, we typically will proceed with the administration of the yellow fever vaccine. Do you all still find that appropriate guidelines and a cutoff for yellow fever and HIV-positive patients?
Exactly. The CD4 count from 200 to 500 are considered to have limited immune deficit. However, they'd have to have the standard warning of we're not exactly sure what all of the issues are related to yellow fever. For example, age is, there seems to be a higher rate of adverse events associated with age. However, it's not been 100%. There have been persons as young as 22.
Okay. And my only other question is, I just recently attended a conference comparing azithromycin versus ciprofloxacin for traveler's diarrhea. Do y'all see any problems with people traveling to the more common places like Bahamas, Central and South America, sticking with cipro versus azithromycin, or is there a preference in the travel medicine community at this time?
Now, I'm sorry, I missed the beginning part of your question, but you've gone to a conference, and what was the next part you said?
There were a lot of the talk was about using Zithromax versus Cipro in terms of traveler's diarrhea, primarily for resistant bugs. And I was just trying to see if y'all had any preferences or any specific areas that you'd use one versus the other.
Yes, and that's the part where I missed out for a minute. In certain parts of Southeast Asia, there is increasing resistance to the floxacin. So in that part, travel to that part of the world, yes, there is a move towards recommending azithromycin. It has not been as well demonstrated in other parts of the world, so currently that's where we are recommending it, but monitoring the other areas.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Dr. Vivian Belmuso, you may ask your question.
Yeah, thank you. I have a couple of questions, kind of unrelated. First of all, in terms of administration of yellow fever vaccine, how liberal are you with vaccine administration? For example, someone who's on a chronic low dose of prednisone, I have a patient who needs to show proof of yellow fever vaccination for a trip into Mali and has been on 5 milligrams of prednisone every other day for several years. That's one question I have, and also related to that is how are you guys managing people who are taking these new agents for rheumatoid arthritis and so on and so forth, and whether you feel that has an effect on the immune system. The other question I have, which is a little unrelated, is what are your thoughts or advice or, you know, position in terms of working with people to convince them of the need of travel medicine in the face of the fact that insurance does not cover most of these services?
Okay, I think I've got all three parts. Let me deal with the rheumatoid arthritis and those medications. Yes, the number of medications that are being used are expanding. Many of the agents that we typically think of as either anti-cancer or anti-inflammatory are being used in a wider variety of illnesses, and patients are improving and then come into clinic and want to take that trip of a lifetime that they've always dreamt of. So this is an increasing challenge. The agents, the anti-TNF-alphas and the other agents, there are, in our new version of the yellow book coming out in May, we're able to cite, and if you do write in, we can forward you the reference, have stated that the effects on the immune system are not completely understood. And so particularly live virus vaccines would not be recommended in those populations because it's just not known what their effect is, and patients are subject to increased infections. So, that being said, we do have to watch the new agents as they appear, and turn it in some cases to our colleagues who are watching the infection rate as a baseline and use that information, because there's not a lot of other studied information on vaccines we're having to extrapolate. On your patient going to Mali, they are on a low-dose of steroid, they're having to go to Mali, they have to make this trip, and that seems to be the case. In looking at a patient, in any case, we often make the recommendations, you know, they have to make the trip. If they're going to a country that has a yellow fever requirement, and maybe the patient is only going to a part of the country where there is not a risk, back to our discussion in South America, if a patient's going high elevation, a waiver is sometimes indicated. And again, I'll refer people to the yellow book and to the online. It's, I believe, Chapter 8 that deals, Chapter 9, it deals with the immunocompromised. So if your patient does have to go and is on a low dose of steroids, considered a less than 20 milligrams a day, for the purposes of pre-travel preparation, they're not considered to be immunosuppressed. But again, you would have to have a full discussion of the issues and potential adverse effects with yellow fever, and that we're not completely sure what all the triggers are. I discussed AIDS with the previous caller, but also, for example, thymus has been implicated, and what role it plays in the immune system, and whatever the underlying disease that the patient's being treated for has to be taken into account also.
Yeah, it's one thing that's coming up increasingly, though, is a lot of people just are unable to get their visas without these, and some of them are cruise companies that are requiring it, and I have people who are 90 years old. So how easily are waivers accepted? I mean, are they generally accepted? When are people able to enter countries with medical waivers if they're legitimate medical waivers, or can people be banned from entering?
It all depends, and that has to be discussed with the client also. There are varying levels of standards of who's doing the inspection at the destination.
Mm-hmm.
So no one cannot give a blanket assurance.
Right.
In some cases, they're not necessarily accepted. In some cases, people are given the offer to have the vaccination there, or people are given the offer to turn around. So, yes, that has to be discussed in the balance. But in many cases, they are accepted, but it is a case-by-case situation, and how long a person is staying. And we have heard reports that in places that are less often, and again, cruise ships have a lot of people on them, but they're not highly visited the way airports are, that it can be a little more variable.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh, and the last, how do you convince people for travel? That's always an issue with prevention, but we try to emphasize on several issues, which is there's several. If they're spending a lot of money on their trip, then spending a little bit more to try and guarantee that they have a good time on their trip is one approach that we've taken. Again, for persons traveling abroad, and we weren't able to present all of the statistics today, but they can sometimes be used in a future situation, which describes the number of people who seek medical care abroad, and our goal is to try to prevent that. Even if there are, example, vaccines that are not covered, the counseling that goes along with the information is usually valuable and that people have not necessarily thought about. And many of the vaccines now are actually becoming routine. So oftentimes the recommendation from the travel medicine, and they can either go to sometimes the county health department or to their own doctor to get the basic vaccines, for example, hepatitis A, and being up to date on when measles and tetanus are some of the core recommendations, and then polio for various parts of the world, and oftentimes those will be covered by their primary care. So those are some of the strategies that we've tried to approach. Particularly for persons that are older, the issues related to medical transport and arranging for care, not wanting to be transported back. It can be a whole lot more expensive to be transported back to the U.S. than to take a few steps of precaution, but that's something that we have in preventive medicine, always trying to spend a few pennies on prevention instead of a pound of cure.
Right.
We have time for two more questions. Mm-hmm. Are there any more questions?
Lisa, your line is open.
Yeah, can you hear me? I have a question about rabies. Can I go ahead and ask it?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I have a question specific to the rabies pre-exposure prophylaxis, and I'm wondering if someone does get the pre-exposure prophylaxis of 3 on the right schedule, does that actually buy them time if they're exposed to rabies? After the fact, when they're in a foreign country, do they get extra time before they have to go get the last 2 shots, or is it still the same within 24-hour recommendation?
It buys a little more time. However, the issue is always what kind of a bite, how severe, and where it was on their hand, whether it's on their face or on their hands or on their feet, those all make a difference. So it does buy a little bit more time. However, if someone's in a remote area in which they need to seek getting the vaccine, that can often mean traveling to a major center, such as a Singapore, a Bangkok, a Shanghai, and that can involve travel over several days. So we're always a little bit leery about telling people how much time in case they're delayed.
Great, thank you.
Gary Burke, your line is open.
Hi. I just have a couple of questions. I've been giving travel advice to business travelers for years, many of whom are engineers who read the CDC guidelines obsessively and take them quite literally. And issues are particularly around, like, Japanese encephalitis vaccine. My understanding is there have been almost no cases of non-military Japanese encephalitis in something like 30 years. And similarly, issues around malaria prophylaxis. What's the cost benefit that you take into account versus the side effects of the drug and the need for prophylaxis in major cities, for example, Bangkok?
All very good questions, and all questions that we're trying to address better denominators ourselves, because the baseline data on which, for example, the Japanese estimates and using the 30 days have been derived. So that would be a large factor, you know, how long is the person staying. So I assume these are people that are going to be, for example, when they're talking about Japanese encephalitis in major cities, they're talking about long-term stays?
A month or so, yes.
Yeah. Because a 30 days would be the recommendation for giving Japanese encephalitis. As I said, it's hard to determine for a couple of reasons, which is there have also been changes over the past dozen or so years in the vaccination practices in the countries. For example, in Japan, almost everyone is vaccinated. And trying to determine what the frequency of travelers who are vaccine immune would be in order to detect a single case. That's one of our challenges. So that we're always grappling with the fact is that absence of a case in the absence of risk, and in what percentage of travelers go to an area for a certain duration. So we are actively trying to have better answers to that, but can only go on the expert opinion that we have now for Japanese encephalitis. For malaria, similar discussion, similar issues in terms of if the person is traveling to an area for example, in India, the discussions are going on currently. There are, the whole country is colored in as a malaria risk. And if a traveler is going specifically to an urban area, the question is, will they be spending entirely all of their time? We found in certain instances where people for one night maybe go out to a remote area for dinner. And, for example, are not always following all of their procedures. So that is one of the concerns and questions. Our European colleagues have been grappling with this and have done some tailored mapping. However, conditions can change rapidly, and they just experienced that in which an area that had been considered lower risk, suddenly there were human cases detected. The thing to balance for us, as opposed to our European colleagues, is we said earlier in the presentation, approximately 17% of U.S. citizens travel outside the United States for more than one night. In Europe, out of the U.K., they have more traveling per year than they have of a population. So many people are traveling more often. I'm not saying every person in the U.K. travels outside every year, but the degree of travel is so much greater that there is awareness across the entire country of the risk. And we must grapple with the fact that people still come back to the United States and die from malaria. That's not necessarily recognized. So those are a variety of the factors that we do try to balance that maybe the engineers had not perhaps included, but those are some of the factors that we're trying to take into account.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again, Dr. Burnett, and other staff from the Travelers Health Team for providing our listeners with this information. And I want to thank our listeners for joining us for this call. And in case you didn't get the chance to ask your questions, please send an email to coca@cdc.gov. That's coca@cdc.gov. The recording of this call and a transcript will be posted to the COCA website at www.bt.cdc.gov/COCA. Also, if other members of your staff were not able to dial in due to our technical difficulties, please let them know that our replay number, recording, and transcript will be posted to the COCA site. And stay tuned for our next COCA conference call. Thank you.